Running a business is hard enough. Don't make it harder with a dozen apps that don't talk to each other. One for sales, another for inventory, a separate one for accounting. That's software overload. Odoo is the all-in-one platform that replaces them all. CRM, accounting, inventory, e-commerce, HR. Fully integrated, easy to use, and built to grow with your business. Thousands have already made the switch. Why not you? Try Odoo for free at odoo.com. That's odoo.com.
Attention parents and grandparents. If you're looking for a gift that's more than just a toy, give them something that inspires confidence and adventure all year long. Give them a Guardian bike, the easiest, safest, and number one kids bike on the market. With USA-made, kid-specific frames and patented safety technology, kids are learning to ride in just one day. No training wheels needed. It's why Guardian is America's favorite kids' bike and the New York Times and Wirecutter's top pick 3 years in a row. This holiday season, Guardian is offering their biggest deal of the year. Up to 40% in savings on all bikes, plus $100 in free accessories. Guardian bikes have become the most sought-after gifts of the season, and inventory is going fast, so don't wait. Join over 500,000 happy families who've discovered the magic of Guardian. Shop now at GuardianBikes.com. That's GuardianBikes.com.
Hey everybody, it's Mark Patterson. I'm back again with another great episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. Before we get into today's rock star guest, I want to draw attention to my website, www.markpattisonnfl.com. There's a lot of stuff right there. There's over 270 podcasts. I would appreciate a ratings and review on Apple if you get a chance. It helps with the popularity of the show. It's not about me being popular. It's about all of us being inspired by these amazing guests. I need to be inspired as well. Number two, Searching for the Summit, the movie the NFL shot on my NFL journey up and down Mount Everest is shown there through a link onto NFL 360. It's an epic film, won Emmy Best Picture. So go check that out. And finally, we continue to raise money for Amelia's Everest. My daughter has epilepsy, and all proceeds go to Higher Ground location here in Sun Valley, Los Angeles, and New York. So on that note, let me introduce my guest today. He will sound like a superhero, which he is in sort. His name is Kenton Cool. Kenton, how you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. Yeah, that's quite the intro. Yeah, I don't quite know what to say to that. But how are you? I've already seen outside your window. Looks like you're having fair weather and snow, which I'm always jealous about.
Yeah, so we're broadcasting here from Sun Valley, Idaho. Of course, you are in the UK. You are Brit-based.
It's wet. I mean, even by Brit standards, it's pretty dire. It's been nonstop, relentless, soul-sapping rain. It's been pretty bad.
Well, remember, I'm from Seattle, so I don't think you knew that, but I'm telling you that. So I grew up in the rain, so I understand your weather, you know, your climate. So let me introduce this to the group, and then I want to go backwards just a little bit, because it's always interesting where we find this different motivation. I met you on Mount Everest at base camp, really at Namiche, and the lodge, I can't remember the name, it was called up there, Panoramic or something.
Panorama Lodge, that's right.
Yep, and you were there with your wife and I think one or two or three kids, rugrats running around, it was great. And so ultimately, you have your own expedition going on with another member, but you were somehow or another able to join the Garrett Madison team. And so the kind of the net, and I'll jump to kind of the end and then we'll go back to the beginning, is that now you've now done Mount Everest 16 times, which is completely insane, which, and props to you. It takes tremendous amount of mindset and determination and a lot of things that I think people are going to find interesting about you and what you do and how you go about doing it. But I want to go back to kind of the early years. And I think, you know, both you and I was really inspired by a lot of Northwest climbers, guys who you may have heard of or know, Ed Veesters, the Whitaker brothers and things like that, that they went on later to. Jim Whitaker, I think it was the first American in 1963 to climb Mount Everest. Mm-hmm. And he was inspired by Hillary and their expedition party. Where did you first get the bug? Like, this is something that you want to do because you've made it into a career. It's just amazing how you can take your passion and turn that into something that you can actually financially monetize on.
Yeah, well, I mean, first and foremost, I think you probably know as much about that as I do. You know, professional sports person, guessing that you were into football because you loved it.
Yeah.
And then you find a way of making it work. But if we rewind the clock, I started climbing age 17 or so. So a bit late to the scene. First, just the local climbing wall. Now, we have to remember that climbing walls, this was back in the early 90s. Climbing walls aren't. A climbing wall back then was not a climbing gym, as many of your audience may now sort of recognize. You know, you didn't walk in and it's these fantastic facilities. Back in, it would have been about 92, I think. 91, 92, I first started climbing. And it was literally, if you imagine like a chicken mesh wire structure that's had concrete sprayed onto it. And this was at Brunel University, close to where I grew up. And this was state of the art. Now, this is as good as it got. This is highly polished. You know, it was almost glassy-like, terrible climbing wall, which you would now not even give a second look at. But I went down there with a buddy of mine, kind of fell in love with it a little bit. I was a field hockey player. I played field hockey to a relatively high level.
Yeah.
And then one day my buddy said, hey, listen, you know, I'm going climbing on the sea cliffs in the south of the UK. Do you want to come? I'm like, hell yeah. And then bang. Yeah, all of a sudden, it went from climbing indoors, which is kind of fun, to climbing outdoors with the adrenaline and the sea crashing and the blue sky, because we do occasionally get blue sky in the UK. And it was a completely different experience. And then from there, a little bit like you, perhaps, I deep dived into climbing. And you know, these names kept cropping up. You know, Chris Bonington, Doug Scott, you know, to a certain extent, Hillary, Reinhold Messner, Peter Harbler. And it seemed back in the 90s, it's a bit different now, but it seemed to be to me in the 90s that the place to go was the Alps. And that was a stepping stone to the Himalaya. And from very early on in my climbing career, I just thought, I want to get to the Himalaya. That's where it's at. Whereas today, I mean, I think the sport's changed a little bit, Mark. And maybe a lot of people will climb, a lot of people will just climb indoors. And that's really groovy. A lot of people will just boulder, you know, the small, you know, no ropes, just a bouldering mat, like a crash mat. And it might only be 10 feet high. It's a really great way to get good technique and get strong, actually, for rock climbing. And that's also, you know, amazing. And it's one of the beautiful things about the sport of, you know, air quotes here, climbing. It is multifaceted, whether you're climbing Everest, whether you're climbing 5,000 meter peaks in Alaska, whether you're climbing 10-foot high boulders in Joshua Tree. You know, it's all climbing. Mm. And that's so cool about the sport. But for me, it was big mountains. I was reading the books. I went to Leeds University to study. And there was a climbing club there, which was on fire. The energy. Oh, my God. You haven't seen anything like it. And to give you an idea about how much energy was around this climbing club.
Yeah.
I mean, it really was off the charts. I'm a fully qualified mountain guide. I'm a pin guide on IFMGA, that's International Federation of Mountain Guide Association. It's like, think Top Gun. I'm a bit like that. We're the top X percent. Mm-hmm. And there's maybe 150 British pin guides, and five of us were at Leeds University at the same time. Yeah. So that just gives you an idea of the energy. And it wasn't, you know, when are we going to climb? It was, what are we going to climb?
Yeah.
And it was just relentless. It was all encompassing. And it was at that point that field hockey just dropped off and I just became really focused on climbing. And my first Himalayan expedition, I was still at university, organized a trip to Pakistan. I never really looked back. It was like a crack addiction. Well, I never tried crack, but I can imagine that's what it's like. Once it got me, I just had to run with it.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, you know, as you were describing this and this energy at Leeds University and just, kind of transitioning from field hockey to dabbling in other sports, and then you kind of like really hook on to rock climbing, and I'm in this world with you, right? Yeah, I mean, you are a professional at it, and I'm just a recreational. It's my hobby, but I do it every day. I'm literally in the mountains every day, and like you said, it becomes super addictive, and it's addictive on multiple levels. I love the feeling of accomplishment. I love the feeling of adventure travel, where I'm going to a new foreign country and experiencing all this. This last year, you were talking about the Alps. I went over to Zermatt to do the Matterhorn. I basically got blown off the Matterhorn in September. And so I retreated. I went back down to Chamonix. And I said, if I can't do this one, then let's go after another one. So we climbed Mont Blanc. And that was just a great challenge, right? And so I can say I've done it, I've been there, done that. And so now I'm looking at like, what's the next thing? And it's hard when people say, aren't you just good enough with the seven summits? And the answer is no. And kind of like you, where you've gone up, I mean, it's a little bit different, but where you've gone up Mount Everest, at least 16 times, and you've summited and you've done all these other peaks, which we'll get into. It never gets old or repetitious to me to continue to go up, because I climb a lot of the same mountains around here. When I say I go up, on a daily basis, it's not spending 2 months away from your home and family and everything, but it's still that, like, I've got something in me. I've got all these other things going on at work and things like that. But I know that sometime in my day, I have to carve out, this time to that time, so I can get up and get that fix, which just feeds my soul at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, there's a fantastic book by Alain Vira. It's called Feeding the Rat. And it's about Mao Antoine. He was a climber back in the 70s, early 80s. He was taken from us far too early. And Feeding the Rat is this, I suppose, metaphor for, inside you, you have this, he calls it the rat. And the rat is gnawing away at you, and it's slowly eating you from the inside out. And the only way you can sate the rat is, or satisfy the rat is, you need to feed it whatever it needs. Now, that could be, if you're a cyclist, it's going out on your bike, or maybe it's a runner, or in my case, it's to be, and like you, to be in the hills, to go climbing, to do something. The rat needs to be fed. And depending what you do, how much you put into the rat, that gives you a certain amount of breathing space before the rat needs to be fed again. Now, I'll give you an example. Back in 2003, I went to Nepal. I climbed arguably my hardest Himalayan peak. It left me physically and emotionally scarred, I think. And for quite a while afterwards, the rat was perfectly happy putting his feet up, kicking back, drinking a margarita or something. The rat was super happy. If I go for a day's climbing here, the rat likes that, but the rat needs that the next day. So occasionally the experiences that we can have can almost overfeed the rat. Yeah. And the rat needs a little bit of time to find an equilibrium, but he's always there. He's always going to chip away at your psyche, and he needs, or she needs, feeding. It's a fantastic book, and it's a really good analogy. And then my friends, especially my wife's tuned into it now, and sometimes she just says, you know what? You need to book a flight. I think the rat needs feeding. And it's true. And the other thing that you mentioned, Mark, which some people don't clue into. Now, you mentioned adventure travel.
Yeah.
Because one thing that climbing, I love travel as well. Yeah. And the one thing that I've kind of learned is, I think for me, at least, travel for the sake of travel has very little meaning. One thing that climbing has given me is a purpose to travel. And, I've been to some amazing places. I mean, it was 1993. I'm in Pakistan. I'm 18, 19 years old. And we just climbed a new mountain. New mountain. And it's not high, like 5,500 meters, my first ever sort of new Himalayan mountain. And we come off the back of it, and we have to descend the wrong side of the mountain. So we come into this beautiful meadow. We come out of the snow line. We run out of food. We run out of fuel. There's three of us. And we're coming into a meadow, and there's this young man running towards us. He's got a stick, and he's shouting. And I look at my mates, and we look at this young man. He's probably about the same age as us. He's probably like, 17, 18, something like that. No, he can't speak a word of English. We don't speak a word of Urdu. Doesn't matter. Okay. The sun's beginning to set. He invites us into, he's got his tiny weenie yurt, and he's a goat herder, and he spends all summer on his own in the arse end of nowhere, like in the middle of nowhere at like 4,500 meters on his own. And he's never seen like a Westerner. He doesn't, you know, we just come down, you know, out the mountains, out of nowhere. He invites us in and he shares everything. We have tea, we have cheese and bread. And my friend at the time was a vegan, you know, being unusual back in the early 90s. And I'm looking at Al, and he's rancid goat butter. I'm like, are you going to eat that? And he looks at me and goes, how can I not eat this? This hospitality, you know, I can't not eat this. And it was at that point that I think I fell in love with the people. In that instance, specifically of the Himalayas, but I think it runs to the Andes. I think it runs everywhere. The mountain people and that adventure that you have around travel, be it in the back of the bus or on top of the bus, or you get to the road's been washed away by a landslide, the trek to K2 base camp, or you know, even a trek to Everest base camp. Yeah, I know it's relatively comfortable, but it's still a jaw-dropping, beautiful thing to do.
Yeah.
That for me, certainly as I got a little bit older, that is almost as exciting as the climb itself. That experience of travel, of the people, of the communities that you touch, and the community and the collective that you're with, you know, the team that you're with, is epic.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, I think you're literally the British version of me, because I think about it so much similar. Like I've traveled all over, and back when my kids were younger, you know, I do the Hawaii thing, and you know, you go sit on the beach, and it really has no interest to me anymore. And it's just like I've been so, you know, in the last 10 years in particular, where I've taken this whole nother level of the amount of experiences that I've had, and how many times I'm sitting there sort of like out in your field in the middle of Pakistan with this sheep herder or goat herder. And you're saying, like, if my buddies could see me, what I'm doing right now, you know, like I'm actually saying these things in my head, because it's just such a unique and having that whole ability to adjust and be flexible, and things happen and not everything has to be planned. And that's when truly the magic comes out. And then you tie in a big physical accomplishment around that. And then to me, that is the goal. That is the magic. And like, I've been on all these peaks, and you've been on, you know, way more peaks, I'm sure, than I have. But at the end of the day, I had said this the other day, that I don't remember that many summits, but I remember all the training and all the process it took to leading up to that particular moment, and then going up, like even going back to Everest when we were there with you, you know, the 2 months of leading up to May 23rd, right? I mean, May 23rd was, that was its own animal, but it was all the experiences, like you said, of flying into Lukla and the world's dangerous airport, and then trekking all the way up and going across the swing bridges, which you've done a ton. I mean, and interacting with the different villagers and understanding their life and going into some of those huts. It was just like, this is insane. This is real life school. Right. And reading something about in a book. And to me, there's so fulfilling, you know, nature about that. I want to go back to Pakistan for just a minute before we jump back into Everest. You have climbed K2, I think the world's most dangerous mountain. What was your experience like on K2?
Well, I mean, we were really lucky. I mean, I first went to Pakistan in 93. I went back to Pakistan in 99. And, you know, I've big love affair with Pakistan. You know, didn't have the opportunity to go back there for a long, long time. And you know, it's such a misunderstood country as well. And K2 being one of these things, because, you know, as I mentioned right at the start of this, you know, my sort of heroes were the likes of Chris Bonington and Doug Scott, and they produced these big coffee table books, glorious photographs. This is pre-internet, obviously. And K2 featured heavily, mainly because the Chris Bonington, Doug Scott, they put a big expedition together to try to climb the West Ridge, and one of their cohort, Nick A. Scott, died. And for me growing up, you know, these sorts of stories were very, very powerful. And so K2 is always there. And I actually signed up to go there in 2007 or 8. And then just last minute, just pulled out, you know, lost a heap of cash on it. But, you know, these things happen. And then interestingly enough, I always said that, you know, I would never guide on K2. I also thought it's too much of a dangerous mountain, and more than that, the weather systems. But all of a sudden, there's a long story. I was on Elbrus with a client, and there's a throwaway comment from the client, and I started to think about it and then challenged the client. I said, you know, when you said about climbing K2, you know, were you being serious, or was that just like a flippant comment? He goes, no, serious. And it took us about 3 years to get our stuff together, and there was a COVID year when we couldn't go. And I think this particular client was probably the only client I'd be comfortable to go to K2 with. I'd done a lot of climbing with him. And we just hit it right, in so much that it was just after COVID. It was very difficult to get into Pakistan, even harder to get the Sherpa team into Pakistan. So there was only 70 permits on K2 when we were there, 2021. So there's only 70 permits, 49 summits, I think. And this includes Sherpas. So, you know, a big year for K2 at the time, but, you know, compared with Everest, you know, very, very small year. All the teams were having to pull together. We had great weather. I mean, we had a big period in the middle, like 13 days of bad weather. But that's what you get in the mountains, especially the Karakoram. The acclimatization went really well. We had this big hiatus in the middle. One or two people were a bit pushy. We had a small weather window in the middle. But, you know, I said to my client, we're just going to stick to our guns. We're going to wait for that good weather window, which hopefully will come. And it did. And to be honest, you know, I went there expecting to have to slay dragons, and we found sheep. You know, we found a very convivial, beautiful mountain. All the way up, it was like clockwork. Hmm. And we summited, and actually, you know, gloves off on the top. We spent about an hour on the top. You know, it's a relatively short summit day if you just go up the Abruzzi Spur, you know, the standard route. And yeah, and we were using oxygen and fixed rope. So, you know, any of your listenership out there, yeah, we're not doing a new route. We're not climbing the magic line or anything like that. This is, you know, commercialism in the big mountains. And we're just on top, and I was just thinking, God, yeah, I feel like I probably could have done that without oxygen. You know, summit day is much shorter than every summit day, like 6 hours to the top. That's all it was. But then it changed. And on the way down, it went from being this very benign, beautiful mountain to this savage mistress out of nowhere. And we got down to Camp 3, and we spent the night at Camp 3. And the next day we came down, I was using my body and backpack as a defense to my client. So I got a client in front of me. The rocks are just whistling down. They hadn't been there on the way up. They're whistling down. They're hitting me on the backpack. What were little gullies of snow are now like not even rivulets of water. That water is cascading down these things. And then finally we get to Camp 1. I dive in the tent to get one or two things we left behind. And it looks like a war zone. I mean, everything's melted out in the space of 3 or 4 days. Everything's melted out. There's 7 or 8 stones where we had been sleeping, just come straight through the tent. And I'm saying to the client, right, just, yeah, I'll get the stuff. You stay where you are. You're in a safe zone. So I run across, dodge some rocks, grab all the stuff out of the tent. And we literally run down the last of the snow slopes to get down to advanced base camp. And that would be safety. And we're coming down, and we end up in this big avalanche debris. It's like debris everywhere. It's like, Jesus Christ, you know, where is this? There's like big lumps, and it's like Christ, it's like concrete, and we're trying to get through this, and we get off to one side and on the rocks, and we're safe. And we get to advanced base camp, which is just down a little bit, and there's, you know, the staff are coming up with a can of coke. We're like, hey, you know, we just climbed camp. And then the whole slope avalanches, which we had just been on. And honestly, Mark, if we'd been there 5 minutes, 6 minutes later, I don't think we'd be here to tell the story.
Yeah.
So my impression of K2, I mean, we were really lucky. And I always say this. Yeah. They're big mountains. They command so much respect. They really do. And same with Everest, same with, you know, any big mountain, almost any mountain. Now, the mountain will allow us, if they are feeling generous, that we can sneak up with humility and respect to the summit. And get back down again, we hope. And I think K2 just kind of shook herself a little bit just to say, you know, hey, I let you get to the top, but I could snuff you out like that.
Yeah, well, like you said, like all mountains are like that, in particular the big mountains. And then when you boil it right down to 2K2, it's like like every 1 in 4 or some low percentage of people that try to climb that mountain don't end up coming back. They don't end up coming back because the rocks coming down, because of the steepness, because of the avalanches. And so, I mean, it's intense. And I think you said it perfectly, which is the mountains allow us to visit. They allow us to climb, to potentially get to the top and then go back down. Flipping just for a sec and going to 2021 when I was on Everest with you, and because you were much more nimble and you were kind of just had one client and then your client decided not to go, I think you had summited like the 15th or before that. There's a little window
that
was there, but yeah, it was something like that. You had gone. There was a window that had come open. We hadn't continued to do our rotations, and you said, "I'm out of here." So you had got up, you had come down, and you took off. And then by the time we started, you know, our journey up there, it might have even been before that, like the 10th, because when we took off, you know, we got caught in a cyclone for 3 days up there at Camp 3, yeah. Which is no place to be caught in a cyclone, as you know.
Not at all. I mean, I remember years ago, I was with John Tinker, and John Tinker was the founder of OTT, Out There Trekking, one of the very early 8,000 meter peak commercial teams. And John was talking to me, he said, "You have no idea. You have no idea what hell is like until you experience a storm at 8,000 meters.
Yeah.
And touch wood, I still don't know what hell is like, because I managed to avoid that up to now by either luck or good judgment or good weather forecasting. You know, yeah. I've been super, super lucky. But it's interesting with, you know, what you say there. I mean, I work in a very bespoke way, as you know. I work one-to-one, and it gives me that ability to be nimble, to take those smaller opportunities. So by the time you guys are summited on 23rd, you know, I was back in the UK with my feet up, sipping a beer, watching with trepidation. Because it's always the same. I get home early, and then, you know, social media or, you know, whatever it is, you know, I follow all my friends. I'll be following your journey through the Madison website, or, you know, everything's being reported, and it's always with trepidation, because those mountains, no matter how much we think we understand them, and especially today, and the vibe that's around big mountain climbing now, and it's like, we'll smash it, we'll conquer it, there's a 100% success rate, you know, there is no thing as bad weather, we just push on forward. That's going to kill people.
Yeah. Stupidity. And,
yeah. Yeah. And yeah, I'm every year I get back and I literally hand in my mouth. I check my social media every day just to check how my friends are doing. You know, people like Garrett, people like yourself, you know, like Lucas or, you know, whoever it is.
Yeah.
And it's worrisome. You know, I operate in a dangerous environment. And I think anybody that forgets that, I mean, climbing 8,000 meter peaks, it's called the death zone for a reason.
Yeah.
It's not for shits and giggles. It's a dangerous place to be, my friend.
Well, I do. This is when I say this. I mean this, because it actually happened. So we get. So for those that don't know, Camp 3 on Mount Everest is 23,500 feet. I'm not sure what that interprets to meters, but
it's high, about 7,300 or so, something like that.
Yeah, and you're on sleeping in these tents. They're wedged into the side of the hill, you know, essentially at this 45-degree angle. And I'm literally, you know, you're just, like, you can't do anything. You can't go anywhere. You're locked in for 3 days. And I was thinking, as your mind wanders all over the board in these random thoughts, I had thought about you because you had taken advantage of this, you know, 3 day weather window to like sprint up and come back down, and you were on your way back home, and you're probably sitting in a pub having a beer and a pizza, you know, and I'm in hell so anyways, those things happen. I want to go back on something you said earlier. I think it was 2003, where some mountain in the Himalaya had kind of rocked your world. And so we were talking about the rat and feeding the rat and all that kind of stuff. What happened that made you kind of rethink, is this something that you want to do as a career?
Well, it didn't really make me rethink it as a career. So this is before I was a mountain guide or king guide. I was already guiding.
Yeah.
There's certain places in the world that you don't need to be a pin guide. Now, you want to work in, say, Mont Blanc or Matterhorn or the Eiger, you need to be a pin guide. If you want to work in Nepal, hey, you know, go for it. So I've been working as a guide, but 2003, there was three of us, and we decided that what we wanted to do was there's a big unclimbed route on Annapurna 3. It's been tried a number of times by big Slovenian teams. And Slovenia is to climbing a little bit like Brazil is to football. You know, they're the creme de la creme. Some of the very best climbers in the world ever have come out of Slovenia. And this had repulsed two or three big Slovenian teams that tried this line. And it was myself, the American John Barco, and the other Brit, Ian Parnell. And we decided that we're going to try this line. 7,500 meter peak. So none of us have been that high before. No fixed ropes, no oxygen, no Sherpa support. We just got a cook and a cook boy at base camp. We've got no weather forecasting. We've got no sat phone. There's no means of communication. No, this is about as organic and by fair means as you can get. And base camp was about 10 miles from the bottom of the mountain. So we were like humping shit up and down the mountain for like days to get everything there. And we had acclimatization foray on the mountain, got about halfway up. And then we cut loose and we went for it. And we were out for, I forget now, 10, 12 days round trip. So carrying everything, so it's alpine style climbing, carrying everything on our backs.
Yeah.
And it was harder than we thought. We got bogged down in the middle with some quite hard mixed climbing. Probably this is an altitude like probably M5, M6. So not super hard at sea level, but 7,000 meters, M5, M6 feels pretty damn hard with a big rucksack on your back. And it's day six or day seven by now. And there's one point in particular that Johnny Varco wasn't very well, our powerhouse of an American friend. And he was coughing up blood. And you know, I thought we had pulmonary edema, which is a altitude issue. It's essentially fluid on the lungs. And we, on that particular day, we had a really bad day's climbing, very slow, hard climbing, loose, dangerous. And we hacked out this tiny weenie ledge, maybe foot and a half, 2 foot wide maximum. You know, just long enough for all three of us to kind of lie down. And as the sun set, I was convinced that John wasn't going to be with us in the morning. I was convinced he was going to die overnight. And I remember waking up in the middle of the night, absolutely freezing, because you've got lightweight sleeping bags, you're trying to go light and fast. And I thought John was dead. There was no noise coming from him. And what I found myself doing is kind of wriggling further away down my end of the ledge to try to disassociate myself with what I thought might be going on at the other end of the ledge, i.e. John dying. Mm. And I really struggled to kind of unpack that since I got back. Anyway, I mean, we find, I mean, John woke up in the morning and he was fine. I mean, we never did quite fully establish. And I remember Parnell, who was in the middle, saying, John, and he's like, his thumbs up came out, his bivvy bag. He's like, yeah, man, I'm here. I'm still good. And we were really lucky that the next day we got above most of the difficulties and we were coming onto what we didn't know at the time, but became the summit ridge. And I fell into a crevasse and this crevasse opened up and we could camp inside the crevasse. And for the first time in about 4 or 5 days, we got relatively flat ground and we could put the tent up and we stopped early and we hydrated. And all of a sudden, we got control back because it felt like it was really out of control. Mm. And we got off that mountain. I think we were climbing for 10 straight days, plus getting to and from base camp. And then the last day, we come back down onto the glacier. We decide we're going to push down to base camp, carry everything. I mean, I don't know how heavy the rucksacks were. And we all got lost on the glacier or on the moraines. And we've all split up. We're all in our little worlds of hell with massive rucksacks. We're hungry. We run out of food. We run out of fuel. We should have been together. But it pushed us so far that that cohesive unit that we speak of. I mean, and I do a load of like motivational speaking to organizations about teamwork and risk management and, you know, the power of the collective mindset and all these things. But I kind of feel fraudulent because when we got pushed right to the edge, I mean, really beyond anything that a human being really should do for fun, because let's face it, it's meant to be fun. Yeah, we went to a really goddamn dark place. And then we got on the glacier the friendship had been stretched so much that we were three individuals. We were no longer a team. And we're just struggling our way down these things, lost in our own dark thoughts. And then I did a lecture tour with John Varco immediately afterwards. So he flew to the UK with me. And we kind of went like this. Having been so close, we just grew distant. And that's never really been put back together. We went to go to Gashburn 4 the following year, but his girlfriend, Sue Knott, unfortunately died in Alaska. And, you know, hand on heart, perhaps I should have gone to the funeral. I was working in Europe as a mountain guide, and I didn't go to Europe. And, you know, I really regret that. And I don't think he really forgave me for it. And it all stems back to that experience on the mountain. And that's before you get into the physicality of it. I mean, we were wrecked, absolutely wrecked. And it's at that point that I realized that this illusion that I had since almost 16, 17 of being, you know, I wanted to experience these things like Chris Bonington and Doug Scott. I wanted to have the experience like they had on the Ogre or K2 and things like this. And when I actually experienced, you know, went really deep as you could go, you know, hell man, I don't want to go back there. I really don't. And that, I think, was probably the pinnacle of my personal climbing in the Himalayas. I mean, it was a thing of beauty, but at the same time, it was horrid, 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 horrid. And I think it scarred all three of us. John and Ian climbed again together, and I climbed with Ian, but the three of us, we never quite came back together. It was interesting. I think we just pushed it that little bit too far.
Well, I think one of the things that the mountains can do to certain people, and if you do this long enough, it just stretches you physically, emotionally, mentally, and then you get in really stressful situations where like the storm or this or that, and it's just it really tests the personality. A lot of times when you see these shows here in America, Survivor and these other reality shows where they essentially try to strip everybody down from everything and they put them on an island or something. And then they have all these contests and games. And you see by that, you know, the first week, everybody's happy and great. And by the end, they're all eating at each other. And so it's just taking the human spirit and stressing that as far. And there's like, who can maintain with their wits all the way through? And a lot of times, you know, people don't make it out of that and they're scarred. And, you know, the thing that is at least great in your situation is that you could take a time out. You could like rationalize it, internalize it. And then I don't know how much time came by. You were like, you know what? This is one of those things that happen. These things can happen in the mountains, but you can also have amazing experiences, which your amazing experiences probably dominate these isolated incidences that occur, you know, here and there, but they do happen.
No, 100%. And yeah, I think it's really important to go through these things. I really do. I mean, I wouldn't want to repeat Annapurna 3 for all the tea in China. Now, you could not pay me enough money to go through that again. However, I am so glad that I did go through it. There was so much learning to be unpacked from it. I mean, in its simplest form, and I say this quite a lot when I talk on stage and things, is only when you really stare at, you know, the utmost failure, when you overstep the line and you realize you've gone too far and this is potentially going to cascade into darkness, only then do you realize how light the other side is. And I believe, you know, you've got to go there. Otherwise, you have no understanding about what we actually have. And that's a really important experience. Yeah, and that can come from lots of different things. It doesn't have to be climbing. It just happens to be that mountains is the environment that I operate in. So, you know, you stare into the abyss, i.e. death, and you think, oh, God, this could go wrong. And that's when you kind of back away and realize how important it is that we have what we have and how rich it is. Because, you know, The cliche, I'm going to get the metaphor wrong, but you know, it's only when you realize that you're going to lose something, that's when you value it. And maybe in the build up to 2003, I've been doing expedition after expedition after expedition, like 2, 3, 4 times a year. I'd be away for 8, 9 months of the year and trying to live in Chamonix and climbing and skiing in Chamonix. And then perhaps I didn't realize what I had. And it took this for me to realize, you know, actually, I need to take my foot off the gas a little bit. Otherwise, this might go in the wrong direction. So, you know, I'm forever grateful of what happened. I just wouldn't want to go back there.
Yeah, no, I can appreciate that. You've done the Triple Crown, which is Everest, Lhotse, and Nuptse. I was the, in 2020-21, you don't know this, but, you know, my whole goal, there's, I think there was two or three of us who were, had planned to climb Everest, come down, get in your tent, a couple of hours, and go back up Lhotse. And yep. I didn't make that. I failed that. And a lot of why I failed that is because I was like the super strong guy on the entire group up until summit day. And then I got snow blind. I ran out of oxygen. I didn't have anything to eat. You know, it's just like everything you wouldn't want to have happen. Yep. And so kind of like what you were saying about going to the edge and appreciating, and the easy thing would have been for me to just lie back down. And, you know, you just say, oh, God, man, if I could just take 5 minutes and a quick snooze here. But you're never going to wake up, right?
Yeah, you're not going to get back up again.
You're never going to get back up. And I was by myself, too, coming down. So, you know, it was just one of those things that played out. I would love to go back to experience going up Lhotse, but I don't want to spend 2 months to have that one day, right? So that's my...
Yeah, I get that.
And that's just what it is. But if I could figure out some other way just to kind of like spend a week there and go get it, you know, I would certainly do that. But I want to talk to you about... So just setting this up, because I've been there, but when you were talking about Everest and Lhotse and Nuptse, they all kind of sit 1, 2, 3 together. And Everest is the highest mountain in the world, of course. Lhotse is the fourth highest mountain in the world. Where does Nuptse sit in that?
So Nuptse is like the little – so these three – let's try and set the scene for the audience. So these three mountains make up what's known as the Western Coombe, this amazing hidden valley. Coombe is the Welsh word for sort of valley. And it's one of the most beautiful places in the world. It's maybe – I mean, what is it, Mark? Mile wide at its widest?
Yeah.
If that.
Yeah.
And maybe a couple of miles long. And you can't see it from anywhere. Yeah. You got
like it's like you're in a stadium.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to climb up into it, and it's just bounded at the end by Lhotse and the Lhotse face, and Everest is on your left as you go uphill, and Nuptse is on your, I mean, it's incredible.
Yeah.
So you've got these three peaks, and Nuptse is the 19th highest mountain in the world. I forget exactly what its height is, 7,786 or something. So, I mean, it's a pretty bloody big mountain. Yeah. It's not one of the top 14, but it's only just underneath it. It receives very little attention compared with the others. And, you know, it always struck me as being a pretty obvious thing to do, because like you mentioned, once you are acclimatized, then you can climb multiple peaks. The thing that takes a long time is the acclimatization, letting your body physiologically change with low pressure. Now, there's one or two ways that we can try to hack that these days with like the sort of oxygen tents and things like that. And what we're actually seeing now in the commercial world is once people are acclimatized, they bounce by helicopter from mountain to mountain to mountain to mountain. Probably not my thing, to be honest, but, you know, hey, light is on and burning brightly for the masses. And you know, anybody that enjoys themselves in the mountain, I'm going to high five that. But for me, you know, the Triple Crown, as it became known, of those three mountains was a pretty obvious one to try to do. And added to that, Lhotse, unfortunately, Mark, is one of the most beautiful like lines on an 8,000 meter peak, is this couloir that just bisects the upper part of Mount Lhotse. It's sublimely beautiful. Skied, Christ knows how, by the late Hilary Nilsson.
Had her on my podcast about.
Yeah, very sad when she passed away on Manitou this year. So skied by that. I mean, God knows how. I mean, I could touch either side of the wall. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know how. You know, what should you do? Straight line that? I should watch it. There's apparently an amazing film. I don't know if she straight lined it quite. Anyway. And then Nuptse has this beautiful line on it as well. The North Ridge, first climbed by Doug Scott again. This name that just keeps haunting me all the time. It's Doug Scott, Roger Baxter Jones, Brian Hall, and I forget who the fourth person was. And they climbed it Alpine style back in the 70s. A very aesthetically pleasing line. And it was one of those occasions in 2013, I had a no-show client. He didn't even turn up in Kathmandu. So I'm left like twiddling my thumbs a little bit. I can go home. Well, that's the easy option. Or I can go all in, and I managed to get a permit for NUPSI, and the stars just aligned and everything came together. And there was another team fixing or the commercial permit to climb NUPSI. So they put the rope on most of it. And then right at the top, which has been a bit of a challenge to some people in recent years, the rope stopped. And I was with the amazing Spanish high altitude climber, Alex Tritton, who's just climbed Mount Esaulu in winter, literally just a few days ago. And I was with Alex, and I'm looking at Alex, and Alex wants to climb it, I want to climb it. And, you know, he's got a fantastic alpine background. He's like, hey, you know, let's cut some rope and let's just go without the fixed lines. Let's just climb it how you and I would climb it normally. So he went down, cut maybe 50, 60 meters of line, and then we just like bounced leads until we got to the top. And it was, we had no oxygen with us. Beautiful day. I mean, such a beautiful day in the mountains. And the view of Everest was just jaw-dropping. But for me, that was just the start of one of the most intense 5-6 days of my life, because we summited, we backed down NUPSI. I said goodbye to Alex. So he spent the night at the high camp, and I almost ran round to back down to camp two on Everest, which you know only too well. Yeah. And then the next day, climbed up to camp three, camp four on Everest, summited Everest, and then back round to Lhotse, got involved with a rescue, which unfortunately didn't work out on Lhotse. I was trying to save a Taiwanese climber called Mr. Lee. That didn't work out. So that took pretty much the last of my energy on Lhotse. And it was 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock in the morning, maybe 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning. And I was like, I'm like, you know what? I'm out. I'm checking out. I'm tapping out. I'm out of here. And my Sherpa looked at me, Dorji, you probably remember Dorji. He just looked at me and goes, Kenton, come on. Now, and he knows exactly what buttons to press. And he's looking at me and goes, come on, I've always wanted to climb Lhotse. So he's now making it about him. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, you never told me that. He goes, yeah, I've always wanted to climb Lhotse. Come on, let's climb it together, you and me. But Dorji's like 9:45 in the morning. What the hell? You don't climb an 8,000-meter peak starting at 9:45 in the morning. Go, no, we can do this. Off we went. And we were so lucky. We get to the top just as the weather was deteriorating. We came down in a bit of a storm. It was avalanching and sloughing on the way down. But we got down and we got back down to camp two, and I got back down to base camp the next day. And then had the horror of trying to unpick the whole Mr. Lee thing. I'm not very good with compartmentalizing sort of death in the mountains and the emotional havoc that things like the Johnny Varco incident on Annapurna 3 can have, or this Mr. Lee death. Yeah. And I'm just like, you know what? I'm on a chopper. I'm out of here. I look back on 2013. I'm very proud of that. I said at the time it wouldn't be repeated for 10 years. A couple of people have tried it on and off over the last few years, including Garrett. And as yet, no one's quite managed to do that last little bit.
It's hard. I mean, the one thing that, again, I'm super strong, and you know, I have my hat is off to you. It's always been off to you in terms of your endurance and what you've been able to do. And, you know, I trained like a mother for 2 years because I was supposed to be there in 2020, and then the whole mountain shut down because of COVID, right? And just the amount that the toll that it takes. Now, I would argue that if I had the right kind of nutrition, I just hadn't eaten in like 18, 24 hours. You know, I was just had nothing in the tank, right?
Yeah, and that's going to crush you.
That's going to crush it, yeah. And so it's just like that played into a lot of it. But, you know, at the end of the day, it was what it was. And to go and do not one, but two, but three like that, you know, in succession it's a mother. It's just a heavy load, and you have to have a tremendous amount of self-management on the way that you hydrate yourself. And, you know, obviously you have to keep it going and everything else like that. But getting back into that death thing for a minute, you know, I climbed with a guy named Don Cash down in Antarctica in 2019. And then later that year he had gone up, and he's one of the guys that had gone on the top, raised his hand up and fell over. And, you know, he just was not, we talked about self-management. You're phenomenal at that. That's what you do. And you know when to layer up and layer down, what to eat and when not to eat, and, you know, hydrate, not hydrate, and conditions are coming, when to hold back and go forward. And that just wasn't his game, you know, and he was doing it more to impress his friend versus having that, just that innate passion of being in the mountains and accomplishing, you know, things like that and challenging himself. And, you know, when I was going up there, of course, I stepped over him. And when I was at Camp 4, I think
pretty graphic as well, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it was right around the time that you had climbed, had gone for the summit in 21. There was a British climber that had died, and he was 6 feet from my tent. You know, they just had him kind of, you know, straight. And that's just the reality of mountain climbing. And people have asked, like, how did you feel about that? And I said, you know, it's different because I was just trying to stay alive myself. And I was just worried about what I had to do to make sure I didn't end up in the same boat as that guy. So, you know, in that moment, I didn't have nearly as much emotion as I would have now sitting here at sea level talking about, you know, the tragedy that can happen, you know, on these different mountains. But
I mean, it is a really hard thing to do, because when you get in a death zone, so there's a death on the north side of Everest back in the early 2000s, no, mid-2000s. David Sharp died on the north side of Everest. And there's a, you know, a British guy, all sorts of hoo-ha in the press, you know, people were stepping over him as he was dying, apparently, and all this sort of thing. And I suppose he was a mentor of mine, the owner of Jaggy Globe. I'm going to completely space his name now. So Jaggy Globe gave me my first guiding gig on Everest. Mm-hmm. And I'm completely going to space his name. Anyway, he was on Radio 4, which is a big, you know, very serious radio show, today program on Radio 4. And, you know, he was at the defense of the other climbers who were allegedly walking around this dying man, David Sharp. And he said on the radio show, you have to understand this, you know, this isn't the same as coming across someone who's been run over in, say, you know, a high street in London. Okay. Yeah. You are literally fighting for your own life.
Yeah.
You know, at 8,000 meters, let alone looking after somebody else. And when you put it into that context, you realize, hey, oh my God, now that is so true.
Yeah.
And it's only when I overlay that on what I do, I'm a professional mountain guy. My USP is Everest. Now, people pay me not inconsiderable amounts of money for my experience on Everest. And it's all pretty easy until summit day.
Yeah.
But summit day is going to take no prisoners.
Yeah.
And I'm looking after myself. I'm looking after the Sherpa team. I'm looking after the clients. And you know what? You know, your bandwidth is taken up. You know, there's not much capacity for anything else.
Yeah.
You know, you're sucking O's. Your mind's being starved of oxygen. Your ability for rational thought, because the first thing that goes when you starve your brain of oxygen is your ability for, you know, concise cognitive thought process. You know, making decisions. So the irony is not lost on me. And you're trying to, like, you're trying to assimilate, you know, what the weather's doing, you know, how the client's doing, how much oxygen you've got, you know, and you're trying to look after your own fingers and toes and noses and everything else. I mean, it's a minefield. And you know what? I absolutely love it. I mean, that it's on the edge all the way. And yeah, you've got to get it right. And touch wood, I've always got it. I mean, this isn't being arrogant. You know, I've got it right. And when it goes right, it's a thing of beauty. But the boundary is so, so thin. That tipping point from one side to the other is almost non-existent. And, you know, Don Cash, you know, I didn't know he was a buddy of yours. No, that's a stark reminder that we cannot lower our defenses. You know, we need to be on it from the moment you step out of your tent until the moment you step off the mountain. Yeah. You need to have your guard up, and sometimes it's intuition. You know, it's some gut intuition. It just doesn't feel right, or it feels right. I mean, it can be either way. And people are saying, "Well, how do you know?" And you just, I don't know. You know, today's not the day.
Yep.
And today's not the day that we go for the summit. Today, you know, we wait. Yeah, let's go tomorrow.
Well, everything you're talking, everything you just said, again, it just feeds back into, you know, your passion and all that kind of stuff. Feeding the rat. You know, as long as everything's great, and preparation does mean opportunity, and you got to make sure that you are prepared. And when that opportunity comes, you go for it, and you know when to pull back. You've done 16 summits on Everest now. How many more you got in you?
Well, I'm going back in a few months. So that's 17 upward, inshallah. Maybe one or two more. I mean, the scene's changing, even from when you and I were there in 2021. I mean, that's starting now, 2 years ago. Yeah. Now, the scene is changing. We get a whole new generation of Nepali-run companies coming into it. And that's great for the country. It's great for the people. I love it. But we're also seeing a different mentality of clientele come in. And I'm not really vibing with that. And that's probably as much me as anything else. You know, I'm now the old horse of Everest. I once wrote a piece for GQ called The Young Guns on Everest. And I was one of the young guns. I'm now not the young gun. I'm the old, you know, old guy in the corner. So maybe me that needs to change, but you know, I don't like what I see in commercialism a little bit on the mountain anymore. I got some commitments to clients for this year and certainly for next year. So we see how it goes. I'm never going to say never. I love it there. I absolutely adore it. And I, you know, given a chance, I'll just go back year on year. You've been there. It's a beautiful place.
Well, I also know that there's thousands of mountains and mountain ranges all over the world. And so if not Everest, you know, there's other places to go. Where can people find you?
I'm very easy. Just Google my name, Kenton Cool. There is only one Cool out there, COOL. We didn't even go into the behind the scenes about where that name came from. But yeah, just Google my name. Now I've got I've got my own website, and then I've also got a performance coaching company called InCool Company. I mean, you can find me through you know, either of those avenues, or better still, find me out on the hill. I'm out in the mountains a lot, or on social media. I mean, on Twitter, Instagram, you know, all in normal places.
Yeah. No, love it. Love it. Love it. Listen, I've been chasing you for over a year. It was, you know, when you're at Everest, even though there's downtime, there's also things are always going on. You had a client to manage. We didn't talk that much. I'm glad we finally get caught up. You're a good dude. You got the right moral compass going. I'm so happy for you. And you know, hopefully, I don't know, who knows, maybe you and I can climb one of these days, because I'm passionate about it.
I mean, let's go down the Matterhorn. I think I must have just missed you on that. I was out there in September as well on the Matterhorn. I got snowed off. The Matterhorn, the Eiger, or something further afield, it'd be great to rope up with you. It'd be great to get in the mountains.
I'll ping you after. So listen, stay on. We're gonna end it right now, but I appreciate you coming on. Awesome podcast. You're a stud. Keep it going. Safe travels, all those things. So thank you so much.
Man, my pleasure, man.
All right. There he is. The one, the only Kenton Cool. Thank you.
Guess what, friends? Your next beach vacay is still on sale at CheapCaribbean.com, but not for long. You can unlock $500 off site-wide vacation packages now through December 9th. Plus, Cheap Caribbean has tons of exclusive hotel deals to top-rated all-inclusive resorts in Mexico and the Caribbean. Cyber Week is also the perfect time to gift yourself something tropical this holiday season. Just go to CheapCaribbean.com to unlock your $500 off. Hurry, this awesome offer ends December 9th.
Attention parents and grandparents. If you're looking for a gift that's more than just a toy, give them something that inspires confidence and adventure all year long. Give them a Guardian bike, the easiest, safest, and number one kids bike on the market. With USA-made, kid-specific frames and patented safety technology, kids are learning to ride in just one day. No training wheels needed. It's why Guardian is America's favorite kids bike and the New York Times and Wirecutter's top pick 3 years in a row. This holiday season, Guardian is offering their biggest deal of the year. Up to 40% in savings on all bikes, plus $100 in free accessories. Guardian bikes have become the most sought-after gifts of the season, and inventory is going fast, so don't wait. Join over 500,000 happy families who've discovered the magic of Guardian. Shop now at GuardianBikes.com. That's GuardianBikes.com.